I'm Mindy Todd. Welcome to The Point. We're talking about race and segregation this hour. Later in the program, we sit down with Richard Rothstein. His new book is titled The Color of Law, A Forgotten History of How Our Government Segregated America. But first, we look specifically at the term race. We use it frequently, but what exactly are we referring to when we say race? Skin pigmentation, genetics, ethnicity? Joining us to talk about race and why it's important to consider its meaning is Jill Gordon. She's professor of philosophy at Colby College and guest lecturer at the ongoing series Beyond the Dream, Falmouth Talks Race. Jill, welcome back.
Hello, thank you so much for having me.
Also with us is Jenny Putnam. She's a psychotherapist and one of the organizers of the Beyond the Dream lecture series. Welcome back to you as well.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
So before we get started in the conversation, tell us what Beyond the Dream lecture series is.
Well, so the name Beyond the Dream came up because we realized that here we are 50 plus years after Dr. King's speech, I Have a Dream. And the question arises, how much closer are we to achieving that dream? And I know that there's many people who would say, oh, we're there. But of course, we're not even close to there. So the series is a way for people in Falmouth to talk in a civil way about race and to learn new things that maybe have passed them by about race.
Mm-hmm. And of course, it isn't just people in Falmouth. Anybody can come. Right?
Anybody can come, yes, of course.
All right. So on its face, the term race, it seems pretty straightforward, but when asked to define it, the idea of race becomes much more complicated. Jill, what are some of the notions and perhaps misconceptions we as a society have about race?
Well, I think you mentioned already some of the starting points for what I'll present in Falmouth. We, in a kind of rough and ready way, we think about race as either some kind of physiological presentation to the world, or the way we look, our skin color, facial features, and so forth. And we also think of it as parentage, who our parents are, the race of our parents. And what I'm going to do is to show that when you start scratching the surface there, these kinds of notions, while okay in a kind of rough and ready way, start to fall apart. They don't have a real coherence to them. And so then we're going to go on to explore, well, then what is it that we're doing when we're talking about race? What is it?
So some people define race as genetic or biological differences. Is that a useful way to look at race? What are the limitations of that view?
The limitations, I think, are that it moves us into the territory of thinking of race as a natural, or I'm going to say naturalized, quality of a person. And the reason I think that that's problematic is that in our country, race is not just a neutral identifier. It is connected to an entire history of social hierarchy, exclusion, and so forth. And so when we start thinking about race as something connected to our very biological or genetic beings, it means that those other traits, that other baggage, if you will, gets imported into our very being and who we are. And so I'm going to talk a little bit about what stuff is natural and what stuff is not natural about
it. Yeah, there's
sure,
also no biological basis to saying that race is genetic. There's more variation within what we call races than there is across what we call races.
Exactly. And, I'm going to talk about some of those studies.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Some people feel pretty strongly that their identity is strongly tied to their ethnicity or culture. So what's your response to those who want to be defined by their heritage and are afraid to lose it?
Yes, I think that is perfectly fine and healthy and beneficial in many cases. So, again, the primary thrust of what I want people to think about when we think about race is the history of it. And there's absolutely no doubt that people have connected cultural affinities surrounding race that have to do with language or geographical location or food or manner of speaking and so forth. And those can be very positive aspects of one's identity. One of the things I want to talk about is separating the aspects of race that get ascribed to someone from someone else, that is, in most cases, from people in the dominant culture, whites, mm-hmm. And what one takes on for oneself as, okay, but this is something about my racialized identity that I want, that is meaningful to me and helpful to me.
What are your thoughts on that, Jenny?
You know, I think that also there's this need to hold on to two seemingly contradictory ideas at once, which is a very difficult thing for people to do. So, for example, you might feel like I love my husband very much and I hate him right now, and those two things become difficult to hold on to. But in this case, I think the idea that I belong to this group, this cultural group, and I'm proud of that and I want the benefits of that, but I don't want to exclude people based on that, and I'm also part of this bigger group and there's some fundamental samenesses between all people. And so those two things can be very hard. We tend to want to collapse into one direction or the other. So I don't see color, for example, which is a little bit absurd mm-hmm. of a statement, is a collapse in the direction of we're all exactly the same. And we are fundamentally, essentially different is a collapse into the direction of my identity is unique to just my group. Mm.
We like to think that we don't have bias against certain people, but researchers have discovered that many of us do, whether we think we do or not. So what can you tell us about implicit bias and how our society can shape the biases we have?
Yeah, this is actually something I'm very interested in. And just to clarify, everyone has these implicit biases. And it's because we grow up in this culture that teaches us most often on this unconscious level, all sorts of things about racialized identities. So I think to answer your question about what we can do to prevent this or to move away from it, the most fundamental thing is to educate ourselves about the phenomenon. When does it occur? How does it occur? And to try in our individual lives, whether we're interacting with friends and family or on the job, you know, interviewing people or looking at resumes and so forth, to habituate ourselves to think a little more carefully about what our biases might be, whether we are affected by these sorts of cultural biases. And again, they're everywhere, and we all have them. Mm-hmm. Women have women implicit bias. Non-whites often have implicit bias against other non-whites, and so forth.
And it's interesting. You sort of raise the question of when does it begin, and immediately thought of children, little children. They seem not to have many bias. To them, you know, everything's, you know, everybody's the same.
That's true up to a certain point. Now, I'm not an expert on the psychological research in this particular area, but I think that it's shown that fairly young they do start absorbing some of these cultural ideas.
Yeah. Do you think implicit bias is potentially more dangerous than blatant racism?
I do, and this has to do with a lot of different things, and I'll just I'll mention one in particular. I think as a society we need to move away from thinking about racism as just individual mean people with terrible views who, you know, we don't like this sort of person. And I think we need to be careful in thinking about the ways in which racism functions systematically. Now, social systems, of course, function through the individuals who inhabit them. And so implicit bias, I think, goes hand in hand with the kind of systemic racism that we have in our society. And so, yes, because of its invisibility, because of its kind of deep-rootedness, it needs to be rooted out and to be made visible so that we can move away from, I think, a more insidious kind of racism. Mm.
There is some theory about racism and our desire not to have certain traits. And so we might project aggression and sexuality onto the black man, for example. And I think that now there's beginning to be a realization that a lot of us in the North project all of our implicit biases, all of the parts of ourselves we don't want to know about, onto Southerners or onto impoverished people. It's just another way for us to deny the parts of us that we don't really like very much.
Project Implicit at Harvard University is ongoing research looking at implicit bias. You can test yourself for implicit bias as part of their project, and we're going to have a link to those tests at our website, capeandislands.org. And I'm sure, Jill, you're familiar with that.
Yes, I am. Yeah. I am. And I've taken the test, and I've had my students take the test. I think there's also some really impressive research, and I'm sorry I don't have the details right now at hand, that looks at things like, you know, people looking at exactly the same resume, but with mm-hmm. different names, some that are stereotypically white names, some that are stereotypically black names, and then looking at how people evaluate the quality of those two identical resumes. Okay. Really impressive research.
Yeah, who gets the call for the interview?
Right, exactly.
We'll talk more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. We are talking about the term race. Joining us is Jill Gordon. She's professor of philosophy at Colby College and guest lecturer at the ongoing series Beyond the Dream, Falmouth Talks Race. Also with us is Jenny Putnam. She's one of the organizers of the Beyond the Dream lecture series and a psychotherapist. We make assumptions about genetic differences and racial differences that don't hold up. In fact, a 2016 article in the journal Science called for a shift away from the concept of race in genetics research, claiming race has social meaning, not scientific meaning. How do we move forward to better understand our similarities and our differences, both on a scientific and a community level?
Well, I think Jenny touched on this earlier when she talked about the fact that there is no actual biological genetic marker for race. And I think to answer the question how we move beyond it, again, it's an understanding of what race is. What I'm going to be talking about a little bit in the Falmouth lecture has to do with moving away from thinking of race as a thing, a quality or an inherent aspect of a person, and to talk about a process, which I'm going to call racialization. What are the historical and cultural processes, and by the way, I should also say legal, processes through which categories of race get created, and then how do they function in society? That's the model that I think is more helpful to understand what it is we mean when we talk about race.
Changing our language is often an important first step toward changing our attitudes and perceptions. And we have those important conversations about marginalized groups, say, such as African Americans. What are terms that we should be using if not, you know, black and white? Is there a possibility of making people overly cautious about terminology and thereby preventing conversation from taking place because they're afraid of offending someone?
Yes, there is always that danger, and again, going back to your earlier question about people's own sense of connection to a racialized identity, I think more than just the language, it's understanding why there might be a reason to change our language. That is, if we can come to understand that races are created, that they are historical and cultural factors created through legislation, through cultural systems and institutions, then we understand why it might be important to talk about racialized identities and so forth. I think in terms of how people want to self-identify, African American, Black, Latino, Hispanic, these I think are more individually situated. And I think when we enter into relation with people, we should respect the way that they want to be identified.
I also think that part of the issue is that embarrassment, shame, and aggression are very, very difficult feelings to sit with, and that our avoiding using words is a way for us not to feel that. And if we are going to move forward with this conversation, if we are going to move forward in this country in healing, we have to, we as those who have identified as white, need to become comfortable with those feelings. Mm-hmm.
For a long time, black and darkness have been associated with bad and evil, while light and white associated with purity and good. We even use phrases such as little white lies, black market. Do you think our more general perceptions about black and white influence how we view skin color?
I do, and I'm going to draw on some literature that addresses this. There's one book in particular called White by a scholar named Richard Dyer that looks exactly at these kinds of cultural and symbolic issues, and he looks at it in popular culture. And I think, you know, we were talking earlier about, you know, at what level do children start to pick up on various things? And I think that these are connected ideas. When we look at the way in which we symbolize and represent these things culturally, those are also part of what we absorb when we're just consuming what looks like benign popular culture.
There are very real issues facing our society today that fall along racial lines. Are we in danger of not adequately addressing these issues if we start moving away from using race as a way of identifying people?
Oh, I do think that. And one of the questions I'm going to raise at the end of my talk is, okay, so race isn't a biological, genetic thing that's marked on the body, it's this other thing. Do we or can we move beyond race and get past it and be, I think Jenny mentioned earlier, colorblind? And I am going to answer that with a resounding no. I think we as a nation have never adequately dealt with our racialized past and present. That's why it's present. And so while I think it's important to shift and change perhaps the way we are currently thinking about race, I think it's really important for us to wrestle with this issue and move away from some idea like, you know, we're living in a post-racial society and so forth. Yep. I think that's one more form of denial about what's actually happening here.
I think another way of thinking about that, which is sort of repeating what you just said, but is that race is real. It's real.
Yeah.
It's not it's not an essential biological fact of a person, but it has become a enormous part of our society and is now a real thing.
Right. And I'm just thinking back to you, the anniversary, 50th anniversary of Martin Luther King's Jr.'s speech, I Have a Dream. And I'm wondering, Jill, your thoughts in looking, you know, some people say, yeah, we're there. And others like, no, we're not. I mean, what are your thoughts on where we are today? And are you optimistic that we'll get there?
Well, I think there has been progress, and we can look at empirical data, some empirical data that shows that. But I think we need to look at other aspects. I know we are a very segregated society, and in many ways as segregated as we have ever been. Am I optimistic? I would say I am cautiously optimistic. The current political moment gives me a little pause. I think there has been a kind of permission given to some backwards type thinking of late that worries me, and so I'm hopeful we can sort of move on or maybe pick up where we had left off and make some progress.
Jenny, it's important for us, particularly white people, to be thinking about conversations about race. And when you look at our region specifically, what are some of the topics you think we should be discussing? We're in a predominantly white
area. No, I think we have to be talking about whiteness, actually, a lot more. And I would like to open up that conversation at some point in the near future, because people who identify as white don't actually identify as white. We just are. So there's this, we're human, and then other people are people of color. And I think that the idea that we have to understand that even that position, that we don't have to be identified as anything in particular, is a form of privilege. And to just sit with that for a while, I think, is where we need to go.
Can I just jump in here and say, this is one of the things I will also be talking about on Thursday. I'm going to talk quite a bit about whiteness as a normative racialized category, but racialized nonetheless. And I'm going to talk as well, Jenny, you've really anticipated some of the things that I also think are extremely important. I'm going to emphasize the way in which that very invisibility of our own whiteness functions, and why we need to be very concerned about it and to make the invisible visible.
Yeah, I was going to, Jill, sort of going back to what you were saying about permissions for this backwards thinking. So would you say now it's even more important for these conversations to happen in neighborhoods across the country?
I do. I do think it's more important. And I think it's also more frightening.
Mm-hmm.
I'm grateful for Jenny's contribution of bringing us back to the psychological aspect of this, because I think it's just so important. And, it's more frightening because of that, but all the more important, I think.
Jill Gordon will be giving a talk about the meaning of race tomorrow, Thursday, August 10th at 7 p.m. at the Falmouth Public Library. We'll have more information at our website, capeandislands.org. Jill Gordon's professor of philosophy at Colby College and guest lecturer at the ongoing series Beyond the Dream, Falmouth Talks Race. And Jenny Putnam is one of the organizers and psychotherapists. Thank you both for joining us today.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.